Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to an interview about different qualities of wine. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer A, B, C or D for each question 1 to 6. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
It is New Year's Eve, and we're ready here to bring out the champagne. You might be waiting a little longer before popping the cork. Maybe you're still thinking about whether you want to toast with the cheap stuff, nothing wrong with that, or with something finer. NPR's Allison Aubrey joined us to explain the difference. Oh, that's a nice...
Yeah, the drama of the pop, right?
I mean, I love that sound. That alone makes me feel like we're celebrating something.
That's right.
But talk to me about what's inside the bottle. I'm always curious when I'm at a party or something like that.
Well, you know, a big part of the splash is the effervescence, the bubbles. They kind of tickle your nose and sting your throat. And as those little bubbles surface to the top, they're actually doing something really important.
So this is some kind of hint of whether we're drinking the good stuff or something cheap. It's all about the bubbles.
Yeah, well, the bubbles can be a really good clue. This is actually a nice bottle of sparkling here. And what I want you to do is to look into the glass, look into the flute, if you will.
Okay.
And you can see the steady stream of bubbles rising to the top, right? Well, this is good. The bubbles are actually transferring all of the aroma from the glass up to your nose, sort of heightening the sensory experience of it all. Now, with the good stuff, with fine bubbly, these bubbles will last and last down to your very last sip. But in sharp contrast, if it's cheap bubbly, then the bubbles tend to stream out of the glass very quickly. 1 minute they're here, the next minute they're gone.
Okay, well, you were very nice to have brought a good bottle here. I'm seeing the bubbles still streaming. Why does that mean that this is a fine champagne?
Well, it has to do with the technique, how the bubbly's made. I really wanted to understand this, so I visited a vineyard in New York State in the Finger Lakes region. It's called Chateau Frank, part of Constantine Frank. And I was given a tour there by the third generation winemaker, Fred Frank.
What we're looking at right here are thousands and thousands of bottles of sparkling wine that have been aging on the yeast. So the French call this en tirage.
He held one bottle up. It was a 2006 vintage. He held it up to the light. I see little bits floating around in there.
Right.
What exactly
those
are
the
those?
Yeast. Those little bits or the cloudiness are the yeast cells.
And they actually help explain how Frank coaxes so many of these wonderful tiny bubbles out of his sparkling wines. You see, inside each of these bottles, Frank is deliberately capturing all of the bubble-producing carbon dioxide that's made naturally in the bottle during fermentation.
We bottle these wines with sugar and yeast added and put this crown cap on, so each bottle becomes its own fermentation vessel.
Now, this is completely different from cheap bubblies. They're fermented in huge vats really quickly, and sometimes the carbon dioxide gas is just injected in like a carbonated soft drink or a seltzer water. And so by comparison, the traditional champagne method that Frank uses is time-consuming and labor-intensive, but he says it's worth it.
The benefit of this method is higher quality sparkling wine.
Now, there's lots of romance with champagne, right? The bubbles have been likened to pearls, and it's been said drinking champagne is like drinking the stars.
Tiny bubbles.
This is so familiar.
Love it.
But I have to tell you, David, it is not all celebration. There's a bit of an international dispute brewing here over
champagne.
Allison,
you bring champagne, you bring music. This is wonderful. But international dispute, what's going on?
Well, you see on the label of the Chateau Frank Bubbly I've brought here, which I mentioned was produced in New York State, what do you see that it says here in the bottom left-hand side of the label?
All right, I'll take a look. Bottom left-hand side. It says Méthode Champenoise, if that's my French accent, or maybe it's not a good one.
Méthode Champenoise. It actually means champagne method, right? It's made in the champagne method. And this kind of tells consumers in the know, hey, this bottle of bubbly is worth a little higher price because of the technique used to produce it. But here's the issue. The French do not want to share this term champagne.
It is New Year's Eve, and we're ready here to bring out the champagne. You might be waiting a little longer before popping the cork. Maybe you're still thinking about whether you want to toast with the cheap stuff, nothing wrong with that, or with something finer. NPR's Allison Aubrey joined us to explain the difference. Oh, that's a nice...
Yeah, the drama of the pop, right?
I mean, I love that sound. That alone makes me feel like we're celebrating something.
That's right.
But talk to me about what's inside the bottle. I'm always curious when I'm at a party or something like that.
Well, you know, a big part of the splash is the effervescence, the bubbles. They kind of tickle your nose and sting your throat. And as those little bubbles surface to the top, they're actually doing something really important.
So this is some kind of hint of whether we're drinking the good stuff or something cheap. It's all about the bubbles.
Yeah, well, the bubbles can be a really good clue. This is actually a nice bottle of sparkling here. And what I want you to do is to look into the glass, look into the flute, if you will.
Okay.
And you can see the steady stream of bubbles rising to the top, right? Well, this is good. The bubbles are actually transferring all of the aroma from the glass up to your nose, sort of heightening the sensory experience of it all. Now, with the good stuff, with fine bubbly, these bubbles will last and last down to your very last sip. But in sharp contrast, if it's cheap bubbly, then the bubbles tend to stream out of the glass very quickly. 1 minute they're here, the next minute they're gone.
Okay, well, you were very nice to have brought a good bottle here. I'm seeing the bubbles still streaming. Why does that mean that this is a fine champagne?
Well, it has to do with the technique, how the bubbly's made. I really wanted to understand this, so I visited a vineyard in New York State in the Finger Lakes region. It's called Chateau Frank, part of Constantine Frank. And I was given a tour there by the third-generation winemaker, Fred Frank.
What we're looking at right here are thousands and thousands of bottles of sparkling wine that have been aging on the yeast. So the French call this en tirage.
He held one bottle up. It was a 2006 vintage. He held it up to the light. I see little bits floating around in there.
Those are the yeast. Those little bits or the cloudiness are the yeast cells.
And they actually help explain how Frank coaxes so many of these wonderful tiny bubbles out of his sparkling wines. You see, inside each of these bottles, Frank is deliberately capturing all of the bubble-producing carbon dioxide that's made naturally in the bottle during fermentation.
We bottle these wines with sugar and yeast added and put this crown cap on, so each bottle becomes its own fermentation vessel.
Now, this is completely different from cheap bubblies. They're fermented in huge vats really quickly, and sometimes the carbon dioxide gas is just injected in like a carbonated soft drink or a seltzer water. And so by comparison, the traditional champagne method that Frank uses is time-consuming and labor-intensive, but he says it's worth it.
The benefit of this method is higher quality sparkling wine.
Now, there's lots of romance with champagne, right? The bubbles have been likened to pearls, and it's been said drinking champagne is like drinking the stars.
Tiny bubbles.
This is so familiar.
Love it.
But I have to tell you, David, it is not all celebration. There's a bit of an international dispute brewing here over champagne.
Allison, you bring champagne, you bring music. This is wonderful. But international dispute, what's going on?
Well, you see on the label of the Chateau Frank Bubbly I've brought here, which I mentioned was produced in New York State, what do you see that it says here in the bottom left-hand side of the label?
All right, I'll take a look. Bottom left-hand side. It says Méthode Champenoise, if that's my French accent, or maybe it's not a good one.
Méthode Champenoise. It actually means champagne method, right? It's made in the champagne method. And this kind of tells consumers in the know, hey, this bottle of bubbly is worth a little higher price because of the technique used to produce it. But here's the issue. The French do not want to share this term champagne.
Task 2. You are going to listen to an interview with a family therapist. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 9 with the sentence endings A to L. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Family Feud. Paul, I don't know if you had any bad influences in your life when you were growing up, or at least what your parents thought were bad influences, did you?
Maybe bad influences now.
Now, probably. I guess your father keeps texting. I had one friend, I'm not going to mention his name, but he had a little problem of, when we were teenagers, of borrowing a car, you know, without really letting the owner know that it was being borrowed. And my my parents caught on to this and banned me from ever hanging out with Damien. All right, that was his name. Basically, these friends are called frenemies. What do you do when you have somebody in your life, when your child has somebody in their life that's getting them into trouble? We wanted to find out what you do. I didn't have any problem with them, but my parents did. So I wanted to find out from a pro, what should you do to help your kids get through this very difficult time? Family therapist Jane Nelson is with us for our Family Feud segment. Thanks for being with us, Jane.
My pleasure.
Now, Oprah has turned to you for help, so we're going to do the same thing. You've been on the Oprah Show and many, many other shows. What can you do, what can adults do, parents do, for their kids with these so-called frenemies?
Frenemies, that's an interesting name.
It is. Well, it's basically friends that a little bit of a problem for the kids.
Right. A couple of things about that. I think that instead of saying you can't ever play with those kids or have them as friends, say I'd really like to have them be in our home so you can invite them over, because that's a good way of giving them a good influence. If you think that they're a bad influence, introduce them to a good influence. And because one of the things that we make a mistake when we think we can control our children, mm-hmm. and if they really want to keep that friend, they'll just go underground. They'll just have them, but they won't tell you about it.
Who's been reporting on me? That's exactly, all right, I'm going to admit it now. Except that my mom told me, you know, before she passed away, she already knew this, but I was sneaking out at night. I was slipping out the window and going hanging out with my friends anyway throughout the night, because we just did. You know, when somebody says, no, you can't, you just say, oh, yes, I can, and you just figure out a way to get around it.
Exactly. I'm so glad that you know that, because a couple of things. It's never just one thing. But there's two other points I'd like to make, and one is that I think that parents try to micromanage their kids' lives too much instead of helping them explore consequences for themselves. It's very different than imposing consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you do that is by helping kids think for themselves by asking what I call curiosity questions. And you know, let me just give you one example. When my daughter was in the ninth grade, she came home and she announced that she was going to get drunk at the ninth grade graduation party. You know, that one of those exciting things that every parent wants to hear. And I just feel
right after, guess what, Mom? I'm pregnant. Yeah, yeah, right up there.
But instead of saying, oh, no, you're not, and if you do, you'll be grounded, I just said, well, tell me more about that. You know, why are you thinking of doing that? And she said, well, a lot of my friends are doing it, and it looks like they're having fun. And I said, well, what do your friends say about you now because you don't drink? And she thought about that and said, oh, they're always telling me how proud they are of me and how much they admire me. And I said, well, what do you think they'll say tomorrow after you do this? And she just thought about that. And see, that's the whole point. You get kids to think.
Right.
And she thought about that and said, well, oh, they'll probably be disappointed. And I said, how do you think you'll feel about yourself? And she said, oh, I'll probably feel like a loser.
Mm-hmm.
And then she came to her own conclusion after exploring the consequences of her choices. She came to this conclusion. She said, oh, I don't think I will.
And you didn't even have to mention what a hangover was, because that would have been next on my list.
Family Feud.
Paul, I don't know if you had any bad influences in your life when you were growing up, or at least what your parents thought were bad influences, did you?
Maybe bad influences now.
Now, probably. I guess your father keeps texting. I had one friend, I'm not going to mention his name, but he had a little problem of, when we were teenagers, of borrowing a car, you know, without really letting the owner know that it was being borrowed. And my parents caught on to this and banned me from ever hanging out with Damien. All right, that was his name. Basically, these friends are called frenemies. What do you do when you have somebody in your life, when your child has somebody in their life that's getting them into trouble? We wanted to find out what you do. I didn't have any problem with them, but my parents did. So I wanted to find out from a pro, what should you do to help your kids get through this very difficult time? Family therapist Jane Nelson is with us for our Family Feud segment. Thanks for being with us, Jane.
My pleasure.
Now, Oprah has turned to you for help, so we're going to do the same thing. You've been on the Oprah Show and many, many other shows. What can you do, what can adults do, parents do, for their kids with these so-called frenemies?
Frenemies, that's an interesting name.
It is.
Well,
it's basically friends that a little bit of a problem for the kids.
Right. There's a couple of things about that. I think that instead of saying you can't ever play with those kids or have them as friends, say I'd really like to have them be in our home so you can invite them over, because that's a good way of giving them a good influence. If you think that they're a bad influence, introduce them to a good influence. And because one of the things that we make a mistake when we think we can control our children, and if they really want to keep that friend, they'll just go underground. They'll just have them, but they won't tell you about it.
Who's been reporting on me? That's exactly, all right, I'm going to admit it now. Except that my mom told me, you know, before she passed away, she already knew this, but I was sneaking out at night. I was slipping out the window and going hanging out with my friends anyway throughout the night, because we just did. You know, when somebody says, no, you can't, you just say, oh, yes, I can, and you just figure out a way to get around it.
Exactly. I'm so glad that you know that, because so a couple of things. There's never just one thing. But there's two other points I'd like to make, and one is that I think that parents try to micromanage their kids' lives too much instead of helping them explore consequences for themselves. It's very different than imposing consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you do that is by helping kids think for themselves by asking what I call curiosity questions. And You know, let me just give you one question. I mean, one example. When my daughter was in the ninth grade, she came home and she announced that she was going to get drunk at the ninth grade graduation party. You know, that one of those exciting things that every parent wants to hear. And I just feel
right
nope.
After, guess what, Mom? I'm pregnant. Yeah, yeah, right up there.
But instead of saying, oh, no, you're not, and if you do, you'll be grounded, I just said, well, tell me more about that. You know, why are you thinking of doing that? And she said, well, a lot of my friends are doing it, and it looks like they're having fun. And I said, well, what do your friends say about you now because you don't drink? And she thought about that and said, oh, they're always telling me how proud they are of me and how much they admire me. And I said, well, what do you think they'll say tomorrow after you do this? And she just thought about that. And see, that's the whole point. You get kids to think.
Right.
And she thought about that and said, well, oh, they'll probably be disappointed. And I said, how do you think you'll feel about yourself? And she said, oh, I'll probably feel like a loser.
Mm-hmm.
And then she came to her own conclusion after exploring the consequences of her choices. She came to this conclusion. She said, oh, I don't think I will.
And you didn't even have to mention what a hangover was, because that would have been next on my list.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a recording about a popular sport in Chicago. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below, then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 1 to 6 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
This was the sound in the city of Chicago last night outside the United Center. Let's go Hawks, those people were chanting. Fans poured into the streets celebrating hockey's Chicago Blackhawks and their second Stanley Cup championship in 4 years. The Blackhawks scored 2 goals late in the third period. It was pretty dramatic. They took Game 6 and the series 4-2 over the Boston Bruins. NPR's David Shaper, who is impartial on every story he covers except hockey, is with us from Chicago. David, congratulations. Fans must be feeling pretty good in Chicago this morning.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Just an incredible finish last night. Nerve-wracking for fans of both teams. I will give Boston their props because I think the Bruins are a really tough, tough team and played extremely well. But, you know, fans were, I think, on their feet, whether they were at the game itself or at home or at a bar, the whole last 5 minutes of the game, because the Bruins were up 2-1, and they're such a strong defensive team with the Blackhawks failing to even generate a shot on goal on a late power play. A lot of us Hawks fans were thinking, we're going to be going to a Game 7 Wednesday night back here in Chicago. But the Hawks kept coming in those final minutes. And with their goalie pulled for an extra attacker, just 76 seconds left, Captain Jonathan Toews makes a beautiful pass to Brian Bickle, who puts the puck in the net to tie the game. And then just 17 seconds later, can you believe it? The Hawks come charging again and score a rebound goal tapped in by David Bolin. Just an incredible, amazing finish.
Well, the emotion, the happy emotion Chicagoans are feeling, I mean, it must be devastating for Boston fans watching everything change in 76 seconds and the whole series go down. Let me ask, I mean, this Stanley Cup will really be remembered for injuries in many ways. There were some banged up people on the ice last night.
There were some really banged up people. You know, hockey is such a physically demanding game, I think more so than any other of the major team sports. You saw Andrew Shaw in the game last night of the Blackhawks take a puck to the face last night, leaving
Ouch.
A little pool of blood on the ice. It was even while he was carrying the cup around, he was blood streaming down his face. But the amazing guy, I think, is Boston center Patrice Bergeron. What he went through is just shocking. He is a critical player for the Bruins. He leaves Saturday night's game in Chicago, taken to the hospital in an ambulance for what we now know is a broken rib and torn cartilage and muscle. Then he comes back just 2 days later and plays last night. It's astounding.
On the ice last night after all that. That's amazing.
Yeah, just astounding what they go through.
Well, you know, if we remove the name Michael Jordan, Chicago is not known for, for piling up championships. I mean, this two NHL championships in four seasons must feel pretty sweet.
It really does. It's incredible. The way this city has rallied around hockey, you know, we've had our little taste of championships here and there with the White Sox in 2005. The Bulls had their six titles in the
This was the sound in the city of Chicago last night outside the United Center. Let's go Hawks, those people were chanting. Fans poured into the streets celebrating hockey's Chicago Blackhawks and their second Stanley Cup championship in 4 years. The Blackhawks scored two goals late in the third period. It was pretty dramatic. They took game six and the series 4-2 over the Boston Bruins. NPR's David Shaper, who is impartial on every story he covers except hockey, is with us from Chicago. David, congratulations. Fans must be feeling pretty good in Chicago this morning.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Just an incredible finish last night. Nerve-wracking for fans of both teams. I will give Boston their props because I think the Bruins are a really tough, tough team and played extremely well. But, you know, fans were, I think, on their feet, whether they were at the game itself or at home or at a bar, the whole last 5 minutes of the game, because the Bruins were up 2-1, and they're such a strong defensive team with the Blackhawks failing to even generate a shot on goal on a late power play. A lot of us Hawks fans were thinking, we're going to be going to a game seven Wednesday night back here in Chicago. But the Hawks kept coming and coming in those final minutes. And with their goalie pulled for an extra attacker, just 76 seconds left, Captain Jonathan Toews makes a beautiful pass to Brian Bickle, who puts the puck in the net to tie the game. And then just 17 seconds later, can you believe it? The Hawks come charging again and score a rebound goal tapped in by David Bolin. Just an incredible, amazing finish.
Well, the emotion, the happy emotion Chicagoans are feeling, I mean, it must be devastating for Boston fans watching everything change in 76 seconds and the whole series go down. Let me ask, I mean, this Stanley Cup will really be remembered for injuries in many ways. There were some banged up people on the ice last night.
There were some really banged up people. You know, hockey is such a physically demanding game, I think more so than any other of the major team sports. You saw Andrew Shaw in the game last night of the Blackhawks take a puck to the face last night, leaving
Ouch.
A little pool of blood on the ice. It was even while he was carrying the cup around, he was blood streaming down his face. But the amazing guy, I think, is Boston center Patrice Bergeron. What he went through is just shocking. He is a critical player for the Bruins. He leaves Saturday night's game in Chicago, taken to the hospital in an ambulance for what we now know is a broken rib and torn cartilage and muscle. Then he comes back just 2 days later and plays last night. It's astounding.
On the ice last night after all that. That's amazing.
Yeah, just astounding what they go through.
Well, you know, if we remove the name Michael Jordan, Chicago is not known for piling up championships. I mean, this two NHL championships in four seasons must feel pretty sweet.
It really does. It's incredible. The way this city has rallied around hockey, you know, we've had our little taste of championships here and there with the White Sox in 2005. The Bulls had their six titles in the
Task 4. You are going to listen to a radio program about summer jobs. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below, then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the speakers 1 to 7 with their statements A to K. There are two extra statements that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first two, 0 and 00, have been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Last week, we asked you to tell us about your memorable summer jobs, and wow, you did not disappoint us.
No, we received hundreds of emails, and they're still coming in.
We have stories detailing plum picking, mango picking, truly itchy business, by the way, apricot cutting.
We heard from not one, but two former vacuum cleaner salesmen, and we learned about unique summer jobs, like sewer smoking.
Sewer smoking?
Evidently, using smoke to find leaks in city sewers is sewer smoking.
Ah, okay. Well, here's a story that is the stuff of anxiety dreams. Nancy Overman of Vienna, Virginia, writes about her first summer job at the age of 14. Hurricane Agnes hit my hometown of Painted Post, New York, on the last day of school in 1972. Our school had been inundated, and I was hired to help clean it up. Nancy tells of dragging waterlogged desks and chairs into the sun and of working through piles and piles of combination locks. My job, Nancy explains, to sort through the wet and muddy tags to find the tags with partially readable numbers and then try every missing number to find the working combination. She says she figured out about half of them.
Well, here's a story from Tom Pensabene of Omaha, who worked as an electrician's helper in New York City in 1971. Tom writes this. First summer assignment was at the McGraw-Hill building. As the building was going up, welders cut holes in the floor every 8 to 10 inches for wires that would be pulled later. My job all summer was to put rubber protectors on the ducts, or as I told friends, I put rubbers on ducts all summer. Tom says, I started around the 8th floor and worked up to the 47th. I was so glad when summer ended. Next summer, I get assigned back to McGraw-Hill, and by then all the wiring was pulled. My job was to put the covers over the same ducts. Payback, I figure, for a truly bad pun.
Oh, my. A few months ago, I asked author Paul Dixon to tell me about the summer job that influenced him the most. And it turns out in the late 1950s, on break from classes at Wesleyan, he had a factory job at the Otis Elevator Company.
And every time when I would go back to school, the professor would say, where did you work last summer? And I'd say, Otis Elevator. And they'd say, there's this horrible professorial laugh. Ha, ha, ha. I'll bet that had its ups and downs. I had to suffer that for 2 years. And those were the days before internships, and then you really got jobs.
And what were you doing?
I was doing different things. I was an assembly line stocker, which was an amazing job.
Hard work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, assembly line stocking, you were running around getting parts, and the person would call out a number. And you didn't know they were going to call out for a box of screws or a side panel. And if you didn't move fast enough, the assembly line would stop. And you would be like a demon for the whole place. I mean, everybody got to stop, and a lot of people were being paid on sort of a productivity level, and the foremen were and everything. So
it's that college kid.
Yeah, yeah, it was real work, and I loved it. I just feel like today kids don't have the opportunity to actually know what blue collar, demanding, piecework kind of jobs are like. It's made me different. It made me less of an elitist, I guess.
Writer Paul Dixon talking about the summer job that had the most influence on him, stocking the assembly line at the Otis Elevator Plant in Yonkers, New York.
Beep.
Last week, we asked you to tell us about your memorable summer jobs, and wow, you did not disappoint us.
No, we received hundreds of emails, and they're still coming in.
We have stories detailing plum picking, mango picking, truly itchy business, by the way, apricot cutting.
We heard from not one, but two former vacuum cleaner salesmen, and we learned about unique summer jobs, like sewer smoking.
Sewer smoking?
Evidently, using smoke to find leaks in city sewers is sewer smoking.
Ah, okay. Well, here's a story that is the stuff of anxiety dreams. Nancy Overman of Vienna, Virginia, writes about her first summer job at the age of 14. Hurricane Agnes hit my hometown of Painted Post, New York, on the last day of school in 1972. Our school had been inundated, and I was hired to help clean it up. Nancy tells of dragging waterlogged desks and chairs into the sun and of working through piles and piles of combination locks. My job, Nancy explains, to sort through the wet and muddy tags to find the tags with partially readable numbers and then try every missing number to find the working combination. She says she figured out about half of them.
Well, here's a story from Tom Pensabene of Omaha, who worked as an electrician's helper in New York City in 1971. Tom writes this. First summer assignment was at the McGraw-Hill building. As the building was going up, welders cut holes in the floor every 8 to 10 inches for wires that would be pulled later. My job all summer was to put rubber protectors on the ducts, or as I told friends, I put rubbers on ducts all summer. Tom says, I started around the 8th floor and worked up to the 47th. I was so glad when summer ended. Next summer, I get assigned back to McGraw-Hill, and by then all the wiring was pulled. My job was to put the covers over the same ducts. Payback, I figure, for a truly bad pun.
Oh, my. A few months ago, I asked author Paul Dixon to tell me about the summer job that influenced him the most, and it turns out in the late 1950s, on break from classes at Wesleyan, he had a factory job at the Otis Elevator Company.
And every time when I would go back to school, the professor would say, where did you work last summer? And I'd said, Otis Elevator. And they'd say, there's this horrible professorial laugh. Ha, ha, ha. I'll bet that had its ups and downs. I had to suffer that for 2 years. And those were the days before internships, and then you really got jobs.
And what were you doing?
I was doing different things. I was an assembly line stocker, which was an amazing job.
Hard work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have assembly line stocking, you were running around getting parts, and the person would call out a number. And you didn't know they were going to call out for a box of screws or a side panel. And if you didn't move fast enough, the assembly line would stop. And you would be like a demon for the whole place. I mean, everybody got to stop, and a lot of people were being paid on sort of a productivity level, and the foremen were and everything. So
it's that college kid.
Yeah, it was real work, and I loved it. I just feel like today kids don't have the opportunity to actually know what blue collar, demanding, piecework kind of jobs are like. It's made me different. It made me less of an elitist, I guess.
Writer Paul Dixon talking about the summer job that had the most influence on him, stocking the assembly line at the Otis Elevator Plant in Yonkers, New York.
This is the end of the listening test.